In Chester Johnson's new book, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, he tells of the journey of two Americans, one black and one white. Damaged Heritage begins with an account of the 1919 Elaine Race Massacre, which, though arguably the worst on record, has been widely unknown for a century due to a whitewashing of our history. In 2008, Chester Johnson was asked to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for a National Day of Repentance when the Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. In his research, Johnson happened upon a treatise by historian and anti-lynching advocate Ida B. Wells on the Elaine Massacre, where more than 100 and possibly hundreds of African-American men, women, and children perished at the hands of white posses, vigilantes, and federal troops in the rich cotton fields of Phillips County, Arkansas. Through this process, Johnson, who grew up one county removed in Drew County, also discovered that his beloved grandfather participated in the massacre. The discovery shook Johnson to his core. Chester Johnson is a poet, essayist, and translator. He served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Department under Jimmy Carter, and is the author of the new book, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, which is published by Pegasus Books, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here.
Forward to our conversation. Just what I just said of the fact that this is so unknown in history, even though it is arguably one of the worst on record, why do you believe that to be the case?
Well, I think there are several factors. One is the remote location where this happened. It's in Phillips County, Arkansas, along the Mississippi River Delta, southeast Arkansas. It was a fairly thriving area at one point. In fact, the county seat was the sixth largest town in Arkansas. But the revolution that has, that's occurred within agricultural production, that sort of thing, it has left that area economically depressed. And I mean, in the clinical sense, it's been depressed. But even beyond that, there has actually been a concerted effort, certainly among whites in that county, for this to be sort of played down. The massacre in that white narrative became a skirmish. The number of people that died, and it's shown in various ways, including an FBI and Justice Department reports that occurred almost immediately after the fighting stopped, has shown that, you know, more than 100 and possibly hundreds of African Americans were killed in this bloody conflict. But there's been a white narrative, and that has, over generations, over the last 100 years, has sort of been the local way of describing it. And even African Americans haven't been very vocal about it up until recently, because of the fear of possible reprisals and repetition of what happened at that time. So I think those are the primary reasons that we just haven't heard about it.
So let us talk about your introduction to the story, because you come into this around 2008. Give us a sense of how you are introduced to the topic.
Well, I was asked by the Episcopal Church to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for a National Day of Repentance when the National Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And at that time, as I was doing my research to write the litany, I came across a treatise that had been written by Ida B. Wells. She's an African-American historian and an anti-lynching advocate of note. And she had written a treatise of about 70 pages entitled The Arkansas Race Riot of 1919. And it became, I was actually somewhat angry about as I learned more about this event, because I grew up one county removed from Phillips County where this massacre occurred, and yet I had I knew nothing about it. I'd never heard about it in school or church or social gatherings, and my friends had never heard of it either as I reached out to them following my research into this area. So I really, into this subject area, so I really wanted to learn more about it. But it was a blessing and a curse in many ways, because I, during the course of my my research, I reacquainted, events came together that had been told to me back when I was a young teenager. My mother had described to me an event that my grandfather, whom I adored, Lonnie Birch, who worked for Missouri Pacific Railroad, and Missouri Pacific Railroad was up to its eyeballs in this massacre. But she had told me about a, she didn't call it a massacre, she called it a well-known race riot, and she described the killings that had occurred in the fields, cotton fields, alongside railroad tracks, and she discussed the topography and all of that. And but you know, at 13, it doesn't necessarily register with you. But as I did my research, I found that around 1919 and 1920, that range, there had been killings of African Americans in Southeast Arkansas, but it was really maybe one or two at a time. There was not this deluge of death that affected the that so many died, over 100 and possibly hundreds of African Americans who perished. So I brought together, and there was other evidence I won't really cite in any detail here, but there was other evidence that also was compelling that my grandfather had actually participated in this in this massacre, and that was an issue that I'm continuing to have to deal with.
The name of the book is Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. So let's go into that a bit. You, in 2014, you're introduced to Sheila Walker. Her grandmother, great-grandmother, and two granduncles were victims of the massacre in Elaine. Tell us about those first meetings and how that relationship has grown over time.
Well, thank you for asking that. It's been a wonderful, that's, you know, real silver lining in this. We another writer who has focused on the massacre and has actually written a book of a number of years ago thought it would be a great idea, because Sheila had been studying the massacre from her perspective over time, and I had been doing that on my own. And so this writer said, you know, the two of you really ought to get together, because you represent the two sides of the massacre. Our first meeting was by telephone for a two-hour conversation. We met about 3 weeks later in Boston at her son's home. And from that point on, I mean, we knew that this was an act of racial reconciliation. I mean, that has a sort of a formal term to it, but it really became significant friendship. And our spouses got involved in it. Our children got involved in it. It has been a wonderful, blessed relationship. And in fact, Sheila wrote the foreword to the book. And she did something in this respect that really helped the relationship, and that is that she knew that I had a great deal of concern about Lonnie's participation in this massacre. And there was a symposium back in the fall of 2014, and at that time, Sheila publicly said, I forgive Lonnie for participating, I think, in this massacre. I think he was a loving and caring person. You can see that through Chester's caring for him. And, you know, he was a good person, and he was born good. But bad circumstances make good people do bad things. And I forgive him for that. And that really removed any kind of cloud or you know, shadow over this reconciliation and evolving friendship. That was very significant. The thing is, I just haven't gotten there. And Sheila's been, you know, she's at peace regarding my my grandfather. I'm not quite there yet.
Is that, I mean, not to use a psychological term, but to use a psychological term, I mean, is that survivor's guilt in some way of looking at, when you say you're not quite there yet, of not being able to give that same level of forgiveness?
It's that. I wouldn't necessarily say it's survival because, and it's not really white guilt. I didn't participate in the massacre. On the other hand, I know that if I don't deal with it, then I am foisting it onto the next generation. That is, if, you know, these mythologies just continue to surface, and we know there's no better example of mythologies surfacing than in our recurring racism, and you know, folks, either white folks either deal with it or we forced it forward. And I have tried to deal with this as effectively as I can, but there is still this lingering issue regarding Lonnie, but Sheila's been very helpful in terms of dealing, and not just in terms of forgiveness, but some guidance how we get there. I mean, white folks don't. I really believe this. White folks don't deal so well with forgiveness. I mean, you look at white folks were really astonished when the family members of Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, those relatives of people who had been killed by Dylann Roof, and they forgave him. And, you know, there was all this astonishment among a number of whites about that. And it is in my opinion is that the forgiveness, whether it's inheritance or whether it's individual, is an important element of racial reconciliation. The ability to accept forgiveness, and that's part of what racial reconciliation is. And I think it was, you know, what King had in mind when he discussed the weapon of love. It was in the context of forgiving whites for their heritage, as well as what they may have done on their own.
Chester Johnson is our guest on the roundtable this morning. The name of the new book is Damaged Heritage, The Alain Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. It is published by Pegasus Books. So let's go back to your relationship with your grandfather. Your dad dies, you're nearly 2 years old, and you move in with your mother's parents in Little Rock. You live there for the better part of 3 years. So tell us about your time there and about those early years with your grandfather, Lonnie.
Well, Lonnie was my 24-hour caretaker. My mother didn't do particularly well in those years, right after my father died, and Lonnie had just retired from the Missouri Pacific Railroad, and we were together. I mean, later on, I heard people referring to that relationship that that I was Lonnie's 24-hour retirement project, and we were just constantly together, whether it was for long walks or whether I'd be sitting in his lap or he would be feeding me or putting me to bed or all of that. And he was I adored him, obviously, and he adored me, and so it was that kind of relationship. And when I don't know whether there was a direct relationship to this, but I left, and within months he passed away. And so, you know, the idea that I learned that not only was he a participant here, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan as well. And that has, all of that is a bit haunting for me, but I'm working on exorcising the demons about that. But it's whether you buy into the issue of hate the sin but love the sinner, which is a sort of a classic view of some folks, which. As I said, I'm not quite there yet.
Racism, you say, is not innate but learned. So your father's gone when you were so young. So what behaviors, what views did you absorb about race and also views that you formed on your own?
Well, thank you for asking that question. After living with my grandparents, my mother brought my older brother and me under a house in a small town in southeast Arkansas, Monticello, right before, as I was entering the first grade. And we didn't have a lot of, we lived sort of on the other side of the tracks, and there weren't a lot of white folks, a lot of white people, children for me to play with. But I became very friendly with a series of African Americans who lived on the street behind us, and we used to play in this field behind. And I don't know whether that impacted me or not, but I have to say that as I grew up, I concluded that, I just didn't feel as white as so many of my white friends later on in school. I mean, it was a segregated environment and segregated schools and all that. And these friends that I had, African Americans, we eventually separated and we never saw each other again. But I knew that I had a little bit different. I mean, I played Little League, and my favorite bat was Larry Doby, who was the American version of Jackie Robinson. And maybe I did that because of sort of an homage for my friends and that friendship. And then I went to Harvard. And my junior year, or with the summer before my junior year, I went to a summer school at Harvard to study under a particular person, but my attention was toward Freedom Summer. Freedom Summer really went to Mississippi to really change the students. Northern students from went to Mississippi to change sort of the environment to register Mississippian black African black Mississippians for voting for and set up these political organizations, political educational facilities for that summer and that sort of thing. And I was just really, and that happened just across the river from where I'd grown up. So my mind was on that. And then I decided my junior year that I had, either I stumbled around Cambridge while a revolution was going on and right in my backyard, or, you know, I just disregard it. Well, wasn't going to disregard. So I, for the next 3.5 years, I spent in the South. And I spent time in Arkansas, and I traveled a lot in the Mississippi and Alabama. I just traveled a lot of the South. I wrote a lot about it. I just focused on it. And at the end of 3.5 years, my views were really codified and congealed about black liberation and civil rights. I come to New York, and almost within a short period of time, King is murdered. And I feel like, you know, I've got to do something for this person who really tried to do something in a nonviolent and in loving way, and I need to pay homage to this person. So I go back and I teach in an all African American public school before the integration of the local education system, again in the Mississippi River Delta, in my home where I had grown up. And it was an important time for me, and I had already codified my views on black liberation and civil rights, and had strong feelings that way. And the rest is sort of history. I continued to be involved. I've lived in New York City for virtually my whole adult life, and then I got involved with this massacre in Elaine, you know, the Elaine Race massacre, and I was the co-chair of the memorial. There was never a memorial for the Elaine Race massacre, and a number of us locally as well. Now, it's not my home, so but I became a co-chair for the Elaine memorial, and we dedicated it on the centennial. And at the end of September of 2019.
As we wrap up our conversation together, I am curious, as we fast forward to the summer of 2020, as you still dealing with the actions of your family and coming to terms with that, as well as working so hard with others in the African-American community to commemorate this event. And as you see things just take off and take to the streets in protests that are nonviolent and occasionally violent, of what you make of this time, number one, and number two, of the opportunity that is presented to us?
I would love to be really optimistic about what race is looking like in the future. But when you think of, you know, 40% of the country supporting racist policies of our current president, you have to take that into account against the very positive actions of this, of these protests throughout the country. I don't want to sound like an alarmist, but during the time that I was working on the memorial, you know, like a couple of years ago, an African American professional and who served on the committee said, you know, the circumstances that exist now are not that dissimilar than when they were in 1919. And I was shocked by it. And he goes through, you know, you have largely a racist president, and Woodrow Wilson was clearly that. You had a view that African American lives were somewhat less valuable than white lives by virtue of the number of deaths that occurred in the Elaine Race Massacre. You had a difference in judicial approach. For example, you know, you had all of these African Americans who died as a result of white at the white hands, both military vigilantes as well as posses, and no whites were brought up for judicial punishment. But the sharecroppers, there were 74 found guilty of first degree, because there were five whites who died in this. Some of them, two of them died of friendly fire, but in this massacre. But so 74 African Americans were found guilty of crimes ranging from first degree murder to night riding, but no whites were. So the ability to take white lives and not necessarily be subject to the same laws that blacks are when they're brought to justice is also present. And so I would love to be really optimistic about it, but for the changes to that sort of enumerated, that needed to be the changes that should be accomplished regarding this, it bears quite a similarity to at least in some respects to the attitudes that existed in 1919. So I really hope that this is a determinative point in time that's going to lead to an absolute change in racial conditions in white and black relationships. But I still have deep reservations about it.
In a recent piece, you wrote, "We now hear the call, the habitual drumbeat, once more for racial healing, but it is simply not possible to have a credible discourse on the subject of racial healing and the absence of a full admission that black lives are routinely, if not normally, treated as largely trivial by a consequential portion of American officialdom, including the police. How else can we account for recurrent and incessant behavior?" And that's the point that you just made, that is what is so difficult to get through to people.
Right.
And to overcome.
Right. You're exactly right. Thank you for quoting that. I appreciate it.
The name of the book is Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. The book is really tremendous, and I thank you so much for sharing with us, and best of luck, and thank you
so much. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Hope you may have me back at some point.
I'd love to have you back on. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Chester Johnson is a poet, essayist, and translator. He's the author of the book Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. He also served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Department under Jimmy Carter. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.